Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name's Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli as a co-host this week, and we're also going to be joined, as usual, by a guest. And we're going to be talking to someone today that's got a foot in the camp of physics and astronomy and cosmology. And we're going to be talking about many things. We're going to be talking about, does physics stop at a certain size of material? That is, mass times mass over R squared. Does that mean anything when you get to very tiny, tiny distances? And the answer is apparently no. Russ, who's our guest?
We're very happy to have Professor Stephen Meyer from the University of Chicago. He's a physicist, an astronomer, and he's going to get us out of the dark. Welcome to Science Studio, Stephen.
Thank you very much.
Well, this is going to be fun, but before we get on to physics and before we get on to anything, and coming from the University of Chicago, there's a tremendous good pedigree of physics from that institution. Let's a little bit about Steve Meyer. How did you get to be a scientist?
I almost couldn't help it. Both of my parents are physicists, and so that's part of if I had rebelled enough, maybe I could have made it out. But really what happened is that because of that, I guess, physics was always the easy path. And so I fell into it a bit. And I've always enjoyed it. I had a high school class with a great teacher that just pulled me into it and made me say, okay, well, this is what I really want to do.
So
I've been following my nose.
Were they academics?
The high school teacher, not.
No, your parents.
Parents were both academics, yes.
What did they study in physics?
My mother was a nuclear physicist, and my father was an astrophysicist. So very similar.
Were they in Chicago?
Did not fall far. Yes, indeed.
So were they involved with the nukes and all that? And
they came after that. They came from Germany in the 50s and came after that, but fell very much into the Chicago that was still a result of that program.
Enrico Fermi
was there, yes. They knew him and overlapped with him a lot.
Wow.
So, and, of course, it was a very they came from Europe, and it was a very European crowd that was part of that that milieu. Yeah.
So we usually don't get predestined scientists in this program. There's usually sort of stories of rebellion against parents as opposed to anything else.
I left that to my brother.
Ah, what did your brother say?
He became an engineer.
Oh, now, we were talking earlier. This is the brother that took a bicycle tour of Bhutan.
That's right.
So our listeners in El Paso will be fascinated by the idea. What an adventurous spirit to go to Bhutan with a bicycle.
And the experience was both beautiful physically, because they had to do a lot of up and down, but also they found the society absolutely unbelievable.
Here at the University of Texas at El Paso, we have a big interaction with Bhutan.
It's a sister school. All the buildings were designed after the Bhutanese model.
I noticed that, and Keith mentioned how it came about.
Yeah, great. Well, that's quick then. We really got from the beginning of your life to being a physicist. It didn't take more than about when you started to talk. How did you decide what type of physics then you wanted to study?
So I fell into it to an extent. I went to University of Wisconsin-Madison as an undergraduate, and there I joined a group by chance that was doing X-ray physics, and I fell into the lab scene. I very much enjoyed working in the lab, and they took me in some ways, and I became part of the group. You know, once you become a part of a science group, you really get pulled in. It's a culture. It's a group of friends and so forth. So I really got pulled into that. Then I decided that I wanted to do something completely different, and I thought about cosmology. Actually, that was a move that I made by thinking about it.
And looking at the stars every night, for example.
And looking at the stars every night. But cosmology had these questions that approach religious questions. Where did the universe come from? Can we learn this by measurement? Can we do experiment that tells us something about this? That was at least the drive that took me into cosmology.
Or another question is, why are all the planets warming? Do the Martians have bigger SUVs than we do?
I've only seen two, and they're driving them all over the place. Actually, one of them, three. One of them's dead now.
So
they're all electric vehicles.
Yeah, that's right.
So when you get into cosmology then, and you say that the big – it is a religious question in many ways. I mean, religion wouldn't be there if we understood where we came from, I think.
That's right.
So where do you say today to your lay public, where have we come from? How has this planet of ours evolved? How has our universe evolved, et cetera? Give us a thumbnail sketch of what people like you who study this seriously, how you would sort of put it all together.
Right. So the first thing I want to say is that it's an experimental effort. So what we do is only – driven by measurements. You, of course, have to wind up expanding what you actually measure. Sure, you measure a bunch of voltages somewhere. You don't just keep the voltages. You make a theory that includes those voltages. But every time something new comes along, you have to include that into your model. The amazing thing about the universe is that we have a model now that is surviving all kinds of measurements. New measurements come along that could refute it, but don't. And that keeps happening. So yeah, we have a model now, the Big Bang model, that just seems to hang in there.
And it's important to note your point that you're an experimentalist.
That's right.
All right. So you go and you do the experiment, and we'll come onto those in a minute. And then, you know, you get in the model, which is the mathematics, and you're sort of trying to bring the two together.
And you stand there. In fact, the thing that that motivates experimentalists is to break it. Right? Can we do an experiment that shows it to be false? That makes you famous, by the way.
And you know, the thing I would say to some of the discussion here is when I was in graduate school, we knew what was happening. The universe exploded, and then it contracted. Everything was going on in a cycle. Now we know it's not
doing that. Right. And how do we know that? We know it from measurement. And in fact, measurement has really every decade or so changed the picture in some fundamental way, but added to it, not really changed it.
So I think the separation between the experiment and measurement and the theology, you have to admit everything's separate.
That's right. That's right. And the goals of science is kind of to break the story rather or test the story. If it survives it, that's fine. But certainly the story is being tested all the time.
So then tell us, what is the current state of the universe?
So the current picture is the universe started from a very small thing. And this is this business of a Big Bang. And underwent, initially at least, an expansion that's different from the expansion we're undergoing now, namely exponentially. It grew faster and faster. Something made that stop. We don't know what it was. That era is called the inflationary era. And in fact, the properties of that era set the seeds for the things that we now see.
For our audience, the inflationary period is a period when more matter was appearing from the spot, if you will.
That's right. At the end of inflation, matter appeared. And in fact, it's probably the energy that was in inflation turned into the matter.
Yeah. So we have the matter that we have, and that's it after the inflationary period. There's no new matter?
There is no new matter. That's right. Okay. Matter underwent nucleosynthesis, so it was all, at that time, it was all hydrogen and helium, and that has become other chemicals since then in reprocessing. That's stars and processes that followed. But all of the matter and all of the dark matter, which we will get to, was generated at that time. And it's that expansion that kind of fed the initial expansion that we now see. We're still coasting. Well, we were coasting till about half the age of the universe, with stars attracting other stars and galaxies attracting other galaxies, slowing down that expansion. And we expected, actually, as little as 15 years ago, that slowing down would maybe eventually turn around and, as you mentioned, be something that would turn around and start collapsing again. The big surprise 15 years ago, and this is an example of breaking a theory that exists, is that the measurements seem to show that the universe has now started to expand again. So it was coasting until it was roughly 6 billion years old, and now it's expanding faster again.
It's such an interesting point because when I was in school, the physicists were so satisfied. We got it figured out. Everything's closed back and forth, back and forth.
Right.
We don't need to do anything else.
Right.
And now we're in an era where we really don't know a lot.
That's right. So that's fair. And it's a perfect example, I think, of how science works. That idea, which was the story, has been changed to now be one where we're now expanding faster and faster. We don't know why, but it's a measurement. It appears to be true.
When you said seem, because you used that word.
I did.
And that's not the sort of the norm that one hears from an experimentalist
right.
over time. I mean, what does that mean? It seems to be accelerating.
Right. Well, this is the thing that comes to one of the two darks that we'll probably talk about. The two darks are dark energy and dark matter. They're very different. Dark is the only thing they have in common, and as I like to say, they're both misnomers. However, dark energy is the thing we have named this seeming to accelerate faster. The reason I say—
So you need a force to make the
You need
expansion.
Some kind of a force. You need a thing. We tie
right.
it, we put a name to it, but we don't know what it is.
I mean, if there was an infinite vacuum, wouldn't everything accelerate into it?
Well, the vacuum is the universe. And so what do you mean by into it? It's not like it's over there and you're
Well, it's an infinite three-dimensional vacuum.
Yes.
And if there's a spot with gases here, it's just going to expand into the infinite.
No. But it's the vacuum itself that's expanding. No, you have the wrong picture.
Oh, I see.
It's
okay.
The vacuum itself. Right. It's not expanding into the vacuum. It's the vacuum itself expanding.
Okay.
And the problem with it is that it seems to expand faster and faster. And one of the other problems with it is that unlike something where you expand it and it becomes less dense, the dark energy seems to have the same energy density when you expand it. So when you double the size of a box, you have twice as much dark energy. So it's a runaway process. It grows faster and faster.
How does a vacuum expand? Because my friends out there listening who are from the history department or from the baseball team downtown or whatever, they're going to say, "What? A vacuum's nothing in it."
That's right.
So how do you know something with nothing in it is expanding? I mean, there's a density feature here, but if the density is zero, what does it mean?
So my easiest way to show what I'm talking about, and it's not a perfect analogy, is to say you have a balloon in front of you, and you go around, you measure the surface area. Then you blow it up, and you say, well, what's the surface area now? And guess what? It's bigger. And what is it that you made bigger? Well, the surface area is bigger. That's the kind of expansion I'm talking about. So the three space, the volume, just got bigger. Now, we can't picture that in our brains.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean there's no logical inconsistency.
But you're an experimentalist. You've somehow measured the size of this vacuum. You've seen the outside of the balloon.
How? We haven't seen the outside. What we've seen is that everything in it is moving away from us now.
Right.
And the further away something is, the faster it's moving away from it. And that's exactly what the dots on a balloon. If I painted dots on the balloon and blew it up, that's exactly what the dots would do.
But it also tells us about the dimensions of our universe in some way.
It tells us, well, one part of it is that three dimensions is what we move around in, but may not be the whole story.
But didn't you say it was also filled with dark matter?
It's filled with dark matter, and it's filled with regular matter, and also
so it's not exactly a vacuum as we would know it.
No, that's right. There's stuff in it. But we picture the vacuum as being the underlying stage of space-time that everything plays out on, and that space-time itself is the thing that's expanding.
So the dark energy is this energy that is causing now this rapid expansion after a period, though, of a relative calm.
That's right.
I mean, that's also extraordinarily interesting. You know, what on earth was going on in the static period between these two large growths?
So I put it a little bit differently.
Yeah.
At one time when the universe was smaller, the density of matter was higher.
Yes.
The universe expands, density of matter becomes lower, but dark energy doesn't get lower density. Eventually, it becomes the dominant thing.
Okay, got you. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Russ Chianelli is here, and we're talking to Professor Steve Meyer from the University of Chicago, and we're talking, as you've just heard, all about very interesting things to do with space. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Vaccines are a powerful preventive therapy, yet many would be surprised how unstable they are to even small changes in temperature. Without refrigeration, vaccines can lose their potency and become unusable.
Antibiotics also need cooling. While that's not a problem in the U.S., it is in developing countries where a clinic may be a hut. Refrigeration accounts for 80% of a vaccine's cost, yet half of the world's vaccines are still lost yearly from cooling problems.
That's why researchers have intensely focused on stabilizing vaccines and other drugs in room temperature or higher. They've come up with an unexpected solution by wrapping them in silk.
That's great. My vaccine will dress better than me. Silk is a protein that, in a purified state, forms sheets with strands of amino acids that are cross-linked to give it strength. Inside these sheets are small pockets that researchers can place vaccines and drugs where they can be protected from extreme changes in temperature and moisture.
For example, the MMR vaccine for mumps, measles, and rubella was stable for up to 6 months at body temperature and even at 140 degrees Fahrenheit for an extended period of time. At that same temperature, silk also was able to protect two common antibiotics, penicillin and tetracycline.
This technology can drastically lower waste and cost and make medically vital drugs more available. Future research could identify other protective proteins, but for now, the best vaccines and drugs in the future may be wearing silk.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Steve Meyer from the University of Chicago Department of Physics and Astronomy. And Steve, you've just got to the point of sort of nicely explaining to us, to the limit that we can all understand what is really not understandable yet, that is dark energy. And the other half of that equation that you said is another misnomer, but there's the dark matter, the mass, and then totally unrelated.
Totally unrelated.
So tell us now, you know, with our own little cosmology, our own little universe here, our own little galaxy, what is dark matter?
So dark matter is something that was known about before we had this problem of having to deal with dark energy. And it's something that astronomers have known about for some time. And that is if you weigh the mass of the galaxy, for example, it's five times the mass of the stars that are in it. In the past, people thought, well, maybe these things are, you know, small planets or something that is the usual stuff.
That we don't see.
That we don't see. It's just dark, so we don't see it. Now, that doesn't work. And so the thought now is that there is a kind of matter that isn't the usual baryons, isn't protons and neutrons, is something totally different. But it's still particles, and it's still something that you could measure something about
Just tell us how you measure the mass. I mean, what are the experiments that you do to measure the mass of stars and galaxies?
This is an old story. One way to do it is to measure how fast galaxies rotate. Their rotation rate is dependent on how much mass is in it. And if you just do that experiment or you make that measurement, you discover that the stars in it can't hold the galaxy together. If it was just the mass of the stars, the galaxy would fly apart.
Isn't this got something to do with Einstein's biggest mistake?
The dark energy does. The dark matter is a different issue. But the dark energy is, in fact, Einstein's mistake. And the problem with that, by the way—
He knew it.
He put it in there to fix a problem that was a misunderstanding on his part. And yet it's a perfect fit to what we now call dark energy, experimentally.
So you can get lucky once in a while.
Yeah, he did.
So let's get this right. We know the mass, we think we know the mass of galaxies because we're measuring rotations, and you know, there's a relationship in physics that says if this is the speed of rotation, then the mass of this unit must be such and such.
Right.
But if the material out there is this very tiny, tiny scale where physics no longer works, then maybe the process is just false. So just go to us now and sort of leave that hanging as a question and tell us how physics changes as the particles get smaller and smaller and smaller.
Okay.
And then try to relate the two if you could.
So I'm going to get away from particles now.
Okay.
Because it's not particles that
right.
get smaller and smaller. Rather, it is the thinking about physics at different scales. And so there's two things you have to do. First of all, there is a scale at which if you take some matter and you squeeze it smaller and smaller, eventually it becomes a black hole. Okay, so you can squeeze something down to the point where the escape velocity is the speed of light. Nothing can come out of it.
That's even the light doesn't come out.
Even the light doesn't come down. So that says that if you have a mass, you can't make something smaller. Quantum mechanics works the other way. That is to say, if you take something with a given energy and squeeze it, you have to have more and more energy in it to make it that small. These two things work the opposite way. Eventually, you discover a size at which if you put anything into it, squeeze it down to that size, it becomes its own black hole. So you can't have quantum mechanics and relativity functioning at the same time. Totally a thought experiment. This is not experiment. This is thinking about how we know two scales of the universe work. When you put them together, you come up with this thing that at some scale, you can't have both quantum mechanics as we understand it and relativity as we understand it. So it's not even about particles. It's about the underlying things that we really believe.
Intersection of these two areas.
That's right.
And you know, it was interesting because a few months ago we were all worried about how there were going to be black holes when they're trying to measure the Higgs God particle,
right? That's right.
And it didn't happen.
Right. No, it didn't. Not so far as I know.
Talk a little bit about the God particle, the Higgs particle, which I thought somebody said was really discovered up there near you, not over there.
Well, they had been trying at Fermilab very hard to get there. They're troubled because they don't quite have the energy that is now in the machine that's at CERN. The particle is thought to be something that has been thought about for quite some time, and it was one of the mechanisms that delivered mass or was an explanation for the mass of the other particles. Beyond that, I'm the wrong guy to ask about the Higgs particle, except to say that it was a long sought for particle and now appears to have been discovered, and is very much along the lines that people were thinking.
And I think at Fermilab they had some evidence that they thought they got it first, right?
Right.
We'll see what happens there. But this is in the area where the two areas that you were talking about interface, so that's over in the particle side, quantum side.
Yes, but those are all energies and scales that are more than 10 orders of magnitude away from this ultimate Planck
bigger
scale. They're bigger and less energy, so they're not. It's not the scale we're talking about.
So the Planck scale, as
the
you put
Planck
it.
Scale.
Tell us why it's called the Planck and who was Max Planck. And
right. So Max Planck was a guy who actually he was thinking about thermodynamics. He was thinking about light. He was thinking, why does a light bulb have the color that it does? And he had a theory that said that if you took light and said it only could come in packets rather than a continuous thing, then he could make a black body curve. So it's a kind of curve that all things that just emit light emit. So he made a scale size for energy packets. He already at that time realized that this, if he put together that energy scale together with Newton's constant, that it would be a natural set of units for the universe. And that is, in fact, the Planck scale. So this was all at the turn of the, you know, 1900, that he had come up with the basic unit of physics. And what we have discovered as we go on is that, thinking about it more, is that actually physics itself, as we understand it, relativity and quantum mechanics don't work at scales of that scale and smaller. So his unit has become even more important. He had just taken it to be a scale that was an ultimate scale of measurement.
So for the listener, I mean, this expression, well, you've heard of E is equal to mc squared. Everybody knows that. But the other one is E is equal to h nu.
That's
where
right.
H is the Planck constant and nu is the frequency of the light. So therefore, the longer the wavelength, the less energy.
That's
you
right.
know, that you can cook with one or you can give up by cooked
right.
by another.
Your right.
ultraviolet will cook you.
right.
Infrared, you can cook your food.
And we've turned it around and we've said as smaller and smaller wavelength, the bigger and bigger the energy. Eventually you get to a point where your energy is so big you become a black hole because you're so small.
Right.
And physics, we know, can't work there, or it has to be a different picture.
I think we should say that physics always works. The standard physics we had needs modification.
Right. And it's not unusual. It happens all the time. When Newton had a theory for how things move, Einstein added to it. It didn't change Newton's theory. Newton's theory is still right at low speeds, and Einstein's theory is an extension, and this would be the same thing.
Is there a consensus out there that individuals are fighting with and saying, you know, you're crazy for thinking this? And
So on going back to the issue of dark energy and dark matter, there's quite a bit of consensus on the dark matter side and the dark energy. Everybody agrees there's something, what it is and how to explain it. In fact, connecting physics to it, it's just this number, has been very, very difficult. So on that side, there's consensus in some ways, but everybody knows we're running into something that we don't quite know what it is.
You're getting to a point where, you know, this size relationship, physics at the small scale, that seems to me is incredibly fundamental to everything.
Yes.
I mean, you know,
that's
chemistry,
right.
we toy with new materials because we've got a direct usage for new materials. New airliners need new materials, new batteries. Nobody needs the understanding of what goes on in the Planck regime, except it's so damn fundamental.
Right.
The funding of this, I mean, you find this difficult to get funding in this current time, but, you know, governments look at you and say, hey, okay, what's this all about? Let's wait for another 20 years before we do this.
Well, I will say that funding in science is in trouble on all scales, and being practical has a upside
right.
on that front. On the other hand, it's also, I think, generally understood that if you try to direct science from the back, namely what are the uses, then you wind up not having a front end. And so it's, I think, reasonable to
right.
But
to
why,
also
why are you assuming that this isn't useful? We talk about time transportation and transporters and, you know, who knows?
Right. Down the line. So we don't know where this goes, but
right.
the same thing could be said of science that was 100 years ago as to what it's doing for us now. And the example I'll give is that the GPS that you use to drive from here to work and back, you know, that
well, actually,
uses
I know the route. But
oh,
I got,
you know the route.
I got
I'm
the
sorry.
Principle.
So I forget everything, and so I have to have it for every day. Anyway, that thing uses Einstein's relativity in the calculations of where you are. And if it didn't, you'd be way off.
Okay.
So that was science that was on the cutting edge, and nobody believed it everybody said, you are crazy. Things don't work that way. And slowly came into the thing of reality, and now we use it.
Right. No, I'm totally with that. Where I was going to go, you know, governments are the big source of funding.
Yes.
But you find more and more universities now being pulled into the orbits of companies out there trying to make a gizmo to make money. Right.
Right.
And Russell is a perfect example of how that synergy works very nicely.
Yes.
But they only are going to give you money for things where they can see a direct 2-3 year utility.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, you know, how we as scientists get to the people who are the governors of industry, the kings of industry, whatever they call themselves, and say, wait a minute, look, you know, for every dollar you put into what you really want to make money from, maybe 10 cents, maybe 5 cents, maybe something, a fund for doing research in science where there's no apparent immediate return.
Right.
Because we need this.
Right.
And yet those funds are extremely, they're drying up.
They're drying up. And I think it's going to ultimately be a real problem. I think historically, the funding from private companies for basic research was actually better than it is now.
Oh, yes.
And was actually relatively far-reaching. It's natural that when there's a pinch, you have to pull back somewhere, and the place that you pull back is the furthest-looking piece of it.
As you say, if you do that, you've lost the front end, if you like.
It's literally short-sighted. Yeah. That's right. I think this is one place where actually the government is something that maybe has the long view, and it says, look, in cooperation with companies, we have to take the long view and the companies can take the shorter view.
I would say this is an issue that I work on all the time, starting from the front end theory all the way to application. There's lots of developments. It's another show. I'll give you one. It's called NCAT. The National Center for Advanced Translational Sciences.
Okay.
And what they're trying to do, it's NIH, what they're trying to do is get the universities and companies together so that the drugs can get faster to the people.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, but that's a very immediate,
controversial.
Though.
Right.
But that's hardly front end. That's simply trying to make the system quicker and therefore the testing curtailed in some way.
No, I mean,
that's got a very specific.
It has to do with the front end, too.
Well, I don't quite see it, but I mean, I'd take your word for it.
Okay, it has to do with the front end, and I tell them all the time with the good ones that, you know, you've got to have front end.
Steve, let's just finish on where you are right now. What's the thing you think you're on the cusp of understanding, but you can't quite tell us the answer?
So right now we are looking for an observable effect that we can, with an experiment, measure the consequences of physics that happens at this scale, the Planck scale. And there is the possibility that we have a way of making an experiment that uses interferometers, the same thing that Michelson-Morley used to find that there was no ether drift, same instrument.
That was a measurement for the speed of light.
Measurement of the speed of light of the Earth within the speed of light, and determining that the speed of light is constant no matter who you are, fundamental element of relativity. We're using a similar instrument to look for a kind of fluctuation in space-time that is not previously thought to be the case, but would come from physics at that very small scale. And we believe there may be an observable effect. It's a long shot. We believe there may be an observable effect that would tell us somehow about how the physics at the Planck scale, whether it really is the picture that we might be, it won't give us the answer, but it's the physics that's going on at that scale.
Steve Meyer, University of Chicago, astronomer, physicist. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. I was enjoying myself.
Yes, thanks. Please come back. And thanks for taking us out of the dark. And thanks to Norma Martinez for putting us in the light.
Okay. And thanks to listeners out there. As usual, without you, there'd be no program. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Dr. Rodrigo Armijos, a professor at the University of Texas at El Paso, has been awarded over $1 million from the National Institutes of Health to investigate how air pollution affects the cardiovascular health of children. This is the first air pollution study in the U.S. to be conducted for its impact on heart disease in children instead of adults. Read more at Synapse, the region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.